Before I start, there are a couple things to go over. First off, this is not going to be the final episode of our series Death in Houston High Society, like we'd originally planned. There was just way too much to fit into this episode. We'll do one more, and that one will go over Dean's final days and end in a short epilogue kind of thing. Also, something that I believe can be attributed to satanic panic rears its ugly head in this episode. So, we figured it would be a good time to play y'all a clip from one of our favorite shows that just did a detailed and incredible five-part series on that subject. The show is called Texarkana, and the series is titled, And He Doth Appear. We can't recommend Texarkana enough. At the end of this episode, we'll play a clip, the intro of their Satanic Panic series, and we'll provide a link in the show notes to the podcast's website. That about covers it. Now on to the episode.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Whether as the result of his direct or indirect actions, or simply an incredibly lengthy and particularly terrible streak of ill fortune, few individuals who occupy space in the first world have seen the troubles that Dean Goss has. As he descended from his place among Houston's social and political elite, tragedy enveloped Dean. In March of 1982, his first wife, Elaine, was shot at close range in the back of her head with a .22 caliber firearm. In July of 1984, after Dean's restaurant and club, the Cattleman's Cove, was suspiciously vandalized and he pocketed much of the insurance money, his maitre d', James Jackson Brown, was found in the trunk of his own car, riddled with bullet holes. Early the next year, Dean Goss shot himself in the chest with his own gun, which he attributed to a paranoia-induced accident, the product of, he claimed, his house being burglarized twice. 3 years after the death of Elaine, in July of 1985, his second wife Paula was shot at close range in the back of her neck with her own .25 caliber pistol, though several other injuries she sustained would likely have killed her. Paula's throat was slashed and her head crushed in by at least two blows from a blunt object. The murders of Elaine Goss, James Jackson Brown, and Paula Goss remain unsolved at the time of this recording, in August of 2021. Though Dean's second-born son, Craig, was looked at as a strong suspect in both his mother Elaine's and stepmother Paula's murders, the Houston police were never able to sufficiently connect him. The investigation's waters were further muddied by Dean Goss's involvement with a man named Frank Joseph DeMaria, who was indicted in 1968 for hiring hitman Charles Void Harrelson to kill his Houston carpet business competitor, Alan Berg. Dean borrowed money from DeMaria for his first wife's funeral, suggesting the two had conducted business previously, perhaps. Dean Goss never paid Frank DeMaria back. But even after his second wife Paula's terrible overkilling, Dean's troubles were hardly over. In February of 1986, when Houston homicide detectives announced that they'd discovered the gun used to kill Paula Goss, and as a result, the slain woman's brother was offering a $25,000 reward for information leading to an arrest, 49-year-old Dean Goss called the news sensational. The frustration he'd felt since his wife's brutal murder was difficult to live with, Dean told reporters, and he's been fully supportive of the investigation. Dean still wished to move from the home where his two wives were murdered, the man added, though no move had been planned for the immediate future. His 22-year-old son Craig, however, told reporters that his family had no plans to leave the Meyerland neighborhood home. His father, Craig added, is doing okay, just keeping on with life. Meanwhile, the press conference announcing the reward and discovery of the murder weapon led to many calls. But Lieutenant Guy Mason of Houston Homicide told the press that no tips proved to be substantive. Paulagas's brother, Scott Brawley, though, was optimistic that tips were coming in, and as a result, he extended the reward 2 more months. First, it was offered for only 30 days. Scott figured that it would only help the detectives with the case. The cops certainly agreed. There was always the chance that money would be the deciding factor for someone with good information to come forward. Although Scott Brawley and the rest of Paula's family were growing frustrated by the lack of progress in the case, it was hardly the fault of the Houston police, they said. Scott also had some insight that was a bit more on the personal level. He told reporters that he hadn't spoken with Dean or anyone else in the Goss family since before his sister's grisly slaying. Scott Brawley said no attempts have been made by Dean to settle Paula's estate or to help pay her final expenses. Anyway, the brother continued, he didn't plan on returning to Houston until the trial for his sister's murderer takes place. In the first part of this series, we mentioned Dean undergoing lap band surgery to reduce his weight. This took place after Paula's murder, as the investigation moved at a snail's pace. Also, shortly after his second wife's savage death by overkill, Dean attempted to open another restaurant, Dean Goss's South Texas Smokehouse, in Seabrook, at the intersection of Highway 146 and NASA Road 1. It was the last business venture the former Jackie Gleason of Houston undertook. Dean Goss's South Texas Smokehouse folded in late 1985. In the summer of 1986, Dean was once again bitten by the love bug, or lucked into a chunk of change, depending on how you see the man, when he met a 40-year-old two-time divorcee from nearby Clear Lake named Laura. Tragedy struck Laura in May of that year when her parents were hit by a jackknifed semi-truck hauling toxic chemicals. The wreck caused a massive fire, and the chemicals burned so hot that authorities were forced to let the blaze subside and cool until the next day before recovering the bodies. Laura received a substantial insurance settlement from the disaster, the deaths of her parents. Not 2 months before the one-year anniversary of the death of Dean's second wife, Paula, on June 6, 1986, he and Laura skipped town to Las Vegas, Nevada, and got hitched. This time, instead of moving his new wife into his home, Dean opted to move into hers, breaking a deadly curse, perhaps, but certainly not one of disharmony. While Dean spent the one-year anniversary of Paula Brawley Goss's horrific death in a honeymoon phase, the slain woman's family spent the occasion in anguish and frustration. Scott Brawley spoke out about his sister's murder, venting to the press that her murder was an act of rage, or at least turned into an act of rage. He believed the killer was troubled with an extreme mental disorder. Likely, Scott said, paranoid schizophrenia. Now, I'd like to be clear here that Scott Brawley's diagnosis does not reflect our opinion. It's simply what he said out of frustration over the lack of progress in Paula's case. I have personal experience with an individual who lives with this particular disorder, and while many diagnosed with schizophrenia never perform acts of violence, the person I know and love did after the state in which he lived in stopped financial assistance for his medication. That's as far as I wish to go into that. The point is, while Scott's unprofessional diagnosis was careless, it was not completely unwarranted, considering both what was known about the condition in 1986 and the pain he was going through at the time. Anyway, to bring it back to what is relevant, both Scott Brawley and Houston homicide detectives told the press they knew who murdered Paula, but no one could prove it. The cops seem to have latched onto the theory that her murder and the 1982 shooting death of Dean's first wife were connected, carried out by the same killer. They believed that killer, they continually said, was a man with close ties to the Goss family, and these comments were not made arbitrarily. Rather, they were made after the numerous interviews police had conducted since the investigation began. The cops stating such appeared to be their way of agreeing with Scott Brawley's notion that the killer was mentally unstable. Detectives couldn't find any motive for either crime. They were not the result of robbery and were not motivated by rape. Certainly, neither Elaine Goss nor Paula Goss had enemies whose grudges reflected the way in which their lives were taken. Either way, the police seemed confident in their theories, but the lack of evidence and leads to further evidence had them waiting for either the killer to confess or for someone who knew something to come forward with information. The killer knows who he is, and we think we know who he is. He will have that hanging over him for the rest of his life until he comes forward or dies, Harris County Assistant District Attorney Chuck Rosenthal told a reporter, while also keeping the potential suspect's identity close to the chest. Time doesn't necessarily work against us, Rosenthal added. Scott thought about his viciously slain sister every day, the brother said, and though nothing could bring her back, he knew the perpetrator would be punished in this life or the next. The investigation continued at a snail's pace, and a couple years later, Dean Goss began the path to rock bottom. After his failed attempt at running a barbecue joint, the South Texas Smokehouse in Seabrook, Dean and his new wife contemplated opening another restaurant in Houston, and then thought about a comedy club in New Orleans. But contemplation was as far as the would-be plans went. Finally, in 1987, Dean Goss sold his house in Houston's Meyerland neighborhood, the home where both his first and second wife were slain. That put the man in a terrible bind when the following year, his third wife, Laura, kicked him out of her home and subsequently filed for divorce. With nowhere else to go, 52-year-old Dean moved in with his 73-year-old father, James Dean Goss, or J.D. It's unclear how J.D. ended up in Houston. He was a lifelong Dallas resident, at least until the death of his wife and Dean's mother, Bonnie, in 1972. Perhaps her death is the reason. It is also unclear what happened to the $180,000 Dean sold his House of Horrors for, since it's reported that when he moved in with his father, they were scraping by on J.D.'s pension and Social Security checks. Longtime friends of Dean's who had acted for him at the Dean Goss Dinner Theater, and folks he'd met when he was on top of the world as the city's great one, all attempted to talk the man into getting out of Houston for good. H-Town had eaten him up and spit out his bones, and those close to Dean thought the man needed a fresh start, maybe someplace like Florida, one actor friend and poker partner told him. But that same friend said, Dean just wouldn't leave.
He always had something cooking, some new idea working, but none of them ever seemed to reach fruition. They just blew away.
Also in 1987, perhaps adding to the sting of Dean's own failed acting career, a local man who had acted for him at the dinner theater by the name of David Doty landed a starring role alongside Gene Hackman, Terry Garr, and the great Burgess Meredith in the movie Full Moon in Blue Water. Doty's role in the movie, which was filmed in Houston, was a huge deal around town. But Dean was responsible for much of his own grief. The divorce proceedings between him and Laura dragged on for over 2 years. It isn't careless to assume that this was due to Dean trying desperately to get what he thought was sufficient alimony out of his third wife. Soon, fate had another tragic event in store for Dean. On Wednesday, May 2, 1990, 75-year-old J.D. Goss opened up his gun case at the Southwest Houston home he shared with his son Dean. He took out an automatic .22 caliber rifle and put it in the back seat of his Oldsmobile Delta 88. At about 1 p.m., he drove off. Sometime later, J.D. arrived at 2525 Merworth Drive, shadowed by the nearby Houston Astrodome, and parked in the parking lot there. This address, which housed the International Trade Center, had some significance in J.D.'s life. His son's business, the Dean Goss Theater, once occupied space in the same strip. At about 4 p.m., J.D. Goss was seen walking in the lobby of the International Trade Center with the aid of his cane. Presumably, he sought to visit his former employer, who is said to have worked there. At 4:20 p.m., an individual walking by J.D.'s car saw the man slumped over in his back seat, his legs partially out the open door, and blood was everywhere. J.D. was shot in the face, but still clinging to life. Police were called quickly, and the elderly man was rushed to Bentaub Hospital. For 4 days, J.D. held on before succumbing to his wound, though he was unresponsive and never regained consciousness. Back on the day it happened, responding Houston police officers reported back to dispatch that J.D.'s shooting was either suicide or an accident, so homicide detectives were not sent to the scene, but they did become involved in the investigation of the death at some point. J.D. Goss's .22 caliber rifle was given to the department's crime lab, and toxicology tests and an autopsy were ordered. Houston Homicide Sergeant Billy Belk told reporters for the Houston Chronicle that they had a credible witness who saw J.D. get out of the driver's side door of his car, walk to the driver's side back door, open it, and lean in. The witness did not hear a shot, they told detectives, presumably meaning that he saw from inside the International Trade Center. Seeing the man lean into the back seat from there, and the shot occurring inside the vehicle, perhaps, muffled the bang. This witness report seems to contradict J.D. Goss being seen walking around inside the building's lobby at 4 p.m., which also seems credible since they described the man walking with his cane. That's pretty specific. Other witnesses, anyway, say they saw no one approach the Oldsmobile from the time J.D. parked it there. Because of these reports and the fact that there was no indication that any of the man's personal items or property were missing, robbery was ruled out. Suicide, detectives learned, seemed to be a workable theory. They said J.D. had been despondent and depressed about his wife's death. However, that seems like weak reasoning considering Bonnie Goss had died 18 years prior, in 1972. If it were suicide, surely other compounding events or circumstances would had to have been stacked atop Bonnie's death. Perhaps detectives eventually came to that realization as well, since they began early on leaning toward the theory that the shooting was accidental. The Harris County Medical Examiner certainly agreed, and 20 days later, on May 22nd, he officially ruled such after the cops finished performing their investigation. Gunshot residue found on J.D.'s face, authorities said, was consistent with what they often find in accidental shootings. Detectives concluded that J.D. was reaching into the back seat for his rifle, and as he pulled it toward himself, barrel first, the gun went off, shooting him in the face. His body, too, laid upon the rifle when he was found, further strengthening this theory. Dean Goss agreed that his father's death was an accident, but it must be said that it's odd. J.D. Goss was a lifetime gun owner and was well-versed in gun safety measures, but such accidents have happened, of course. Perhaps J.D. forgot to remove the bullet from the chamber. It was the only one in the rifle. Later, Dean Goss found 8 more bullets in the pocket of the clothing his father wore that day. even though the eyewitness, the autopsy findings, and the fact that JD fell atop his gun after the shot, there were some holes in the accident theory. After what the cops called a meticulous search of JD's car, there was no spent bullet casing to be found. Well, at least not until a week later, when Dean Goss called the Houston police to report he had discovered it in a paper grocery bag in the back seat of the vehicle. It had just ejected from the gun into the sack, and the cops neglected to look, I suppose. That mystery was, I guess, solved, but there was another one. What was J.D. Goss doing with the rifle? Dean Goss Jr. commented that his grandfather might have been taking it to the pawn shop in the shopping strip there to sell, but since J.D. never regained consciousness to explain the circumstances of the shooting, exactly what happened that day will likely forever remain a mystery. James Dean Goss's memorial was held at the same funeral home that provided the services for Dean Goss's first wife, Elaine, and second wife, Paula, at George H. Lewis and Sons. Again, they asked Dean to pay in advance for the service. After the death of his father, Dean Goss's world spiraled even further down. He bounced around back and forth, staying with Dean Jr. some, and then Craig. He couldn't afford the nice cigars he used to smoke, and though Dean had always been a drinker, his booze intake was heavier than it had ever been. Finally, the man ended up in a rundown rental house, the conditions of which were described as squalid. Later that year, in December of 1990, Dean and Laura's divorce was finalized. Once extraordinarily successful and on top of the world, hobnobbing with fellow Houston celebrities, tycoon oilmen, and influential political figures, the man had never been so destitute. Just 7 months later, however, Dean sank to a new low. Dean Goss had solid alibis for both his wife Elaine's slaying in 1982 and for the murder of his second wife Paula in 1985. There is absolutely no way either woman died directly at his hands, and there was no clear motive to suggest he'd even hired someone to kill Paula or Elaine, let alone evidence of such. But in July of 1991, Dean started looking mighty suspicious, both in terms of the man's own actions and startling revelations that occurred as the result of those actions. That month, Dean Goss sat his sons down and explained to them that he had found discrepancies in Paula's signatures on her life insurance paperwork. He said that Paula's brother, Scott Brawley, must have somehow gotten a hold of these papers, tampered with the policies, and made changes to them that made him the executor. But it got worse, Dean told his boys. Scott Brawley had switched the beneficiaries of the life insurance from Dean and his sons to Paula's two boys from her previous marriage. Paula's brother, according to the widower, had cheated him and his sons out of an insurance payout. Dean Goss filed a lawsuit against Scott Brawley, alleging such. Deposing Dean's sons Craig, Dean Jr., and the friend who found Paula's body along with Dean Jr., Coy Sevier, Scott Brawley countersued. But the Goss boys and company were hardly the only folks Paula's brother had deposed. There were 11 more witnesses as well. To say there were bombshells in the depositions is, perhaps, an incredible understatement. The lawsuit Dean Goss brought against his slain wife's brother, Scott Brawley, backfired in a big way. You might recall from our last episode, Part 3, that not long before Paula Brawley Goss was savagely slain, she took a trip to South Carolina to visit with family. You might also recall that Paula told relatives that she'd found something out her husband Dean had done and that she could not stay married to him after what she'd learned. Friends of Paula and Dean, a couple by the names of Beth and Frank Bertucci, stated in their deposition that shortly before Paula's murder, she'd confided in them about something. According to Beth and Frank, Dean and Paula had visited them at their New Orleans home in the summer of 1984. When they went back home to Houston, Dean called their friends in the Big Easy and asked for a favor, to call the New Orleans police and report that Dean's car had been broken into and property stolen during their visit. Beth and Frank refused to do it, and when they spoke to Paula a couple weeks later, it was the first she'd heard about a car theft. In fact, Paula knew her and Dean's car had not been burglarized. Paula had also found insurance claims that her husband had filed for property of theirs that wasn't missing at all. This is presumably what Paula Goss meant when she told her family she'd found something out about Dean that solidified her decision to leave him. The discovery of Dean's insurance fraud was huge and left so many other questions. Were the recent burglaries at the Goss' Maryland home a hoax? Simply a ploy to collect insurance money on supposed stolen items? And what about the vandalism at the Cattleman's Cove? Was that set up for the same purpose? That particular question brought forth an even darker one. If the destruction at the restaurant and club was a ploy by Dean to collect on insurance claims, was the murder of maitre d' J.J. Brown somehow related? Feeling she had all she needed for a judge to grant her a divorce from Dean Goss without any trouble, Paula began carrying around a briefcase containing copies of the insurance fraud her husband had committed, among other documents, the nature of which are unclear to us. Paula, in fact, would not let the briefcase leave her sight. She spoke with her New Orleans friends, Beth and Frank, about it, and also her and Dean's friend, Ruby Lee Cady. Charles Jekyll, Paula Goss's employer at her second job, actually saw the briefcase and its contents and referred her to a private investigator named David Baker. Baker apparently thought the services of a different PI were warranted for this particular case and gave Paula the name of another. We'll get to private investigator James Martindale shortly. All of Paula's friends knew she planned to leave Dean after he underwent surgery to remove a cyst from his jaw. She'd also confided in them that she had changed the beneficiaries on her life insurance, a policy with Penn Mutual worth $150,000, and not a penny of the money was going to Dean or his boys. After Paula's murder, Beth and Frank Bertucci were among the folks the police spoke with during the investigation. In her deposition, Beth described a conversation she'd had with Houston homicide detectives. According to Beth, one detective recalled to her Dean's reaction when the cops told him Paula had already altered her life insurance policy.
"Well,"
Dean Goss reportedly said as he snarled,
"the bitch got the last word."
After Paula Brawley Goss was murdered, the briefcase containing Dean's fraud and the other unknown documents disappeared and has never been found. In the days leading up to her murder, Paula hired private investigator James Martindale. In his deposition, the PI said that Paula wanted him to check for wiretaps on her private phone line, which she had gotten after receiving repeated threatening phone calls. Those calls, by the way, did make their way to that private line. Though Martindale said he didn't find a bug on Paula's line, he did find evidence that the telephone junction box in the attic of the Goss home had been tampered with. James Martindale said he could tell Paula was deathly afraid of something, or someone rather, and he assumed at first that it was her husband, Dean. The cloak-and-dagger conditions in which Paula demanded they meet was a clear sign of fear. When they met for the first time at a Houston restaurant, Martindale and Paula devised a plan for him to check the phone lines. The PI was to walk past the home at a set time, and if the coast was clear, if Paula were the only one home, Martindale was to sneak in and do his thing. This is when the private detective sensed the woman's fear. Assuming it was her husband she was afraid of, Martindale made a comment. But Paula corrected him, Dean's in the hospital, she told the PI. It was her stepson, Craig, who she feared. Months before Paula's murder, she and Craig Goss began continually arguing. After the downfall of Dean Goss's Cattleman's Cove restaurant and club, a venture in which Paula lost $150,000, the stress of being the sole provider in the Goss home was getting to Paula. She was constantly having to pinch pennies and keep an eye on the household expenses, and that's not to mention the exhaustion she felt working two jobs. One night, several weeks before Paula's death, that stress boiled over, and what might have been considered a completely normal quarrel under different circumstances took place. Paula and Craig had a disagreement after she caught him removing a frozen dinner from the freezer. Apparently, it got pretty heated, as it ended with Paula ordering Craig from the home. Her stepson moved out shortly thereafter, the move fully funded by his grandfather, J.D. Goss. The threatening phone calls to Paula had begun around the same time she and Craig's troubles with each other began, and Paula confided in her friend Ruby that she suspected her stepson of being the caller. Had she hired private investigator James Martindale a little earlier, perhaps, Paula Goss's fate might have taken a different turn. Beth and Frank Bertucci also had a strange run-in with Craig Goss and a friend. Like the Bertuccis, Coy Sevier, the man who was with Dean Goss Jr. when he found Paula's body, also lived in New Orleans. Coy was a longtime friend of the Goss family. He'd once pursued a career in singing and had performed at the Dean Goss Dinner Theater on a few occasions. But a few months before Paula's death, Coy had recently divorced and had long given up his aspirations of a life in entertainment. After Craig Goss helped Coy remove his belongings from he and his now ex-wife's home, the two made their way to Frank and Beth's house to spend the weekend. On one of those weekend nights, Craig and Coy went bar hopping, leaving the recently divorced man's belongings behind in the Bertucci's home. Curiosity got the best of Frank Bertucci, he said in his deposition, and he began thumbing through notebooks and literature that was among Coy's possessions. There were books about the occult and devil worship, Frank said, and the notebooks contained satanic poetry written by Coy Sevier. When the two men got back from their excursion, Frank testified, Coy Sevier appeared badly beaten, and when asked what happened, he replied that he'd attempted to purge himself, whatever that means. According to Frank, Coy and Craig began speaking of the occult and how much they loathed women. The object of Craig's hate talk, apparently, quickly turned to his stepmother. He'd like to wring her neck, Craig said, according to Frank. Frank said he didn't think much about it. After all, nearly everyone makes comments like that when they're angry at someone. Most of the time, though, I'd personally hazard a guess, the object of such talk doesn't end up brutally murdered in an act of what appeared to be a rage-fueled overkill. Anyway, the talk of devil worship particularly upset Frank Bertucci, he said, since the day had turned to Sunday by then and the man was an Italian Catholic. If you've listened to Gone Cold for a while, you likely know how I feel about claims of devil worship. I'm not calling Frank Bertucci a liar, but this particular part of the deposition is where I had to bite my tongue not to call bullshit. We would be remiss not to point out that at this time in 1991, satanic panic was an out-of-control epidemic that was infecting supposed witnesses in countless murder cases across the country. In virtually every one of those cases, the accusations have been completely unfounded. During the civil battle with Scott Brawley, Dean Goss attempted to hire the Texas-famous private investigator Clyde Wilson to find out who killed Paula and Elaine. You might remember Clyde Wilson from our episodes about the mysterious death of Houston oil tycoon Ed Baker.
I offered him up the same thing I offer a lot of clients.
the private eye would later say.
I told him if he'd take a polygraph and pass, I'd take the case. But however it came out, if he passed or failed, I'd make the results available to the police. He didn't want to take the polygraph, so I didn't take the case.
Dean Goss was served a summons to give a deposition in Scott Brawley's countersuit. The man's second wife's brother had called his bluff. Dean dropped the lawsuit, and the death that surrounds the man, the 1982 murder of his first wife Elaine, the July 1984 murder of James Jackson Brown, Dean's maitre d' at his short-lived restaurant, The Cattleman's Cove, and the July 1985 murder of his second wife, all remain unsolved to this day. Dean was a broken man. The lawsuit against Scott Brawley, his final attempt at swindling a big chunk of change. Friends of the man would later say that at this point, if you didn't speak to Dean Goss first thing in the morning, you may as well forget about it and try to get to him the next. Dean had fallen deeply into alcoholism, his daily goal to booze his way to oblivion. It's no wonder. Word around town was that Dean Goss was a black widower, a man who was responsible for the murder of two wives, the Bluebeard of Houston. But that notion and the way the man was put to trial by sensationalistic television news segments and articles in the newspapers was hardly fair. Other than being a crook, and quite frankly, a complete asshole, there was no proof that Dean Goss ordered the slayings of Elaine and Paula. The man still constantly brought up his wives' murders to friends, often telling them they had no idea what it was like living with the uncertainty. The topic, these friends said, made Dean visibly emotional. Whatever the case, after he dropped the lawsuit, Dean Goss began his final descent. We'll pick it up from there on the next episode of Gone Cold. If you have any information about the murder of Paula Jane Brawley Goss, James Jackson Brown, or Elaine Karen Richmond Goss, please contact Houston Crime Stoppers at 713-222-8477. Don't forget to stick around to the end for a clip from one of our favorite podcasts, Texarkana. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/Gone Cold Podcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as the Slayer Saint and the Riverside Village Massacre, Parts 1 and 2, among others. Thanks so much to everyone who supports us there. We could not do this without you, and we appreciate it beyond words. There will be some changes coming there soon, and I'll let y'all know when I figure out everything. The Houston Press, the Houston Chronicle, the Austin Statesman, KVUE.com, and court documents were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.
On Halloween night, 1972, on the outskirts of San Antonio, the congregants of Castle Hills Baptist held a bonfire in the parking lot of their suburban church. It wasn't a celebration. It was an act of spiritual warfare. They had it on good authority that the world's most powerful witches were gathering in the nearby hills for a black mass, possibly the largest and most sinister such ritual ever held. The church's bonfire was all at once a show of force, a counterattack, and a preemptive strike against the forces of darkness and devilry that had invaded their fine city on this most wicked of nights. And those righteous flames, towering some 12 feet into the night sky, had been built, kindled, and fed on the pages of books. The servants of God had amassed all the works of the serpent, his textbooks, his left-wing leaflets, his comic books, pornography, and rock and roll albums, all of it, and cast their filth into the cleansing flames, filling the valley with light and vanquishing the enemy at their gates. For now.
A month or two after the Castle Hills book burning, Texas Monthly journalist Gregory Curtis interviewed the church's minister, Malcolm Granger, about what happened that night and why. There's been signs something was going to happen in San Antonio for a long time. Earlier that summer, a 28-year-old man named John Todd had come to the church claiming to be a, quote, former Grand Druid, one of the 10 or so highest-ranking witches in the United States. He said he'd recently escaped his satanic coven after a Christian movie convinced him he'd been led astray. His first-hand knowledge of the devil's inner circle compelled him to come to Castle Hills with his prophecy and a warning. A great and terrible darkness was descending on San Antonio, and the signs were everywhere if you knew where to look. Local high school students, some of whom were attending this very church, had been sneaking out to the hills at night to sacrifice dogs to the devil and drink their blood. As the devil's birthday, Halloween, drew near, witches from all over the world were gathering their forces in the city, including Church of Satan founder Anton LaVey, a powerful voodoo priest from Brazil, some high-ranking officials from the Vatican, and radical feminist group, the Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell, or WITCH. The plan was to erect a building in the hills, made entirely of bulletproof glass, that would serve as the new international headquarters of witchcraft, and its completion would mark the advent of the Antichrist. "I was skeptical at first,"
the preacher admitted,
"but I prayed with him and I've heard him testify. There are too many other things happening that all point to this. John even has a scar on his arm from the time he sealed a covenant with Satan in his own blood."
He pulled a folder from his file drawer and spread its contents across the desk for the reporter to examine. Mostly clippings from a recent issue of the Village Voice, anything that made reference to the sort of things they'd burned in the fire. Meditation, astrology, drugs, R-rated movies, and an ad for the TV sitcom Bewitched, which the preacher found particularly disturbing. Alongside all of that was an issue of the popular DC comic book New Gods. The preacher carefully opened it to a well-worn, dog-eared page and tapped his fingertip on an illustration of some villainous creature's contorted face.
"This,"
he said.
"This is very close."
The church youth minister appeared in the office doorway, so the preacher invited her in to elucidate the ways in which the coming darkness had already begun manifesting itself in children. "Any childhood difficulties, anger, frustration, disobedience can be attributed to demon possession,"
she said.
"We can pray and get rid of the demon, but it doesn't do any good if that child goes right back to a house where devils exist." When the rumors of dog sacrifice first surfaced, one of the girls in her ministry tearfully confessed to having attended one of these rituals and offered as penance a list of the other students that she claimed were involved. The church gave the list of names to the school's principal, who then passed it along to the kids' parents. This seems like a good time to mention that earlier in the interview, and seemingly apropos of nothing, the preacher casually told the reporter,
"Cotton Mather hadn't been all wrong."
The good Reverend Mather, of course, having been an orchestrator of the Salem witch trials.
"Humanism, science, rationalism,"
the preacher said, spitting out the words like they were stuck in his teeth.
"They're really the work of the devil. You see, because they tell us not to believe in devils, and that makes us all the more susceptible to them."
We probably don't need to tell you this, but there was no all-star witch convention held in the San Antonio Hills that Halloween night, but there had been a gathering of cultists channeling otherworldly powers and casting their enemies' most sacred accoutrements into the ravenous flames of a bonfire, one they'd built in the parking lot of their own suburban church.
Maybe John Todd was lying or delusional, or maybe he was telling the truth and the Satanists just changed their plans at the last minute. Whatever it was, the preacher believed him. And why shouldn't he? The prophecy was merely a confirmation of what he'd already long suspected and deeply feared. And when he passed the stranger's message along to his flock, they believed it too. And why wouldn't they? He was a trusted authority figure in their community. And besides, they could see the omens for themselves, plain as day, every time they turned on the TV or perused the Village Voice. Every form of media they touched was laced with the same wicked poison that, for years, festered within the rotten husk of American culture. A culture that was becoming more and more alien and frightening to them with every passing day.
But in a way, they were right. A great and terrible darkness was descending, one that traveled on a whisper through the ear of a friend who has it on very good authority that everyone thinks so. Don't you agree? You do agree, don't you? Margaret Atwood once said, "A word after a word after a word is power." And to badly paraphrase Isaac Asimov, a story sufficiently well told is indistinguishable from a spell well cast. We all know the incantations by heart. The rituals and abracadabras required to enchant and to curse. The words we say and the rumors we spread, the lies we tell. Every one of us has the power to conjure real demons into this world. And sometimes the only difference between fact and fantasy is a simple majority opinion. Like the old saying goes, speak of the devil and, well, you know. I'm Ryan Sheffield.
And I'm Brad Dewar.
And this is Texarkana.